It's Friday, March 21st, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Mark this day, perhaps as a turning point in the woke wars, or maybe just part 7 of chapter 30. But maybe we will mark this as a moment because Snow White was released and ignored. The production is a relic of a time when sensitivities overrode entertainment. Some backstory, Peter Dinklage, in an interview with Marc Maron, voiced displeasure at the prospect of dwarves being depicted as mythological cave-dwelling figures, and boom, off to work Disney's PR people go. Quote, to avoid reinforcing stereotypes from the original animated film, we are taking a different approach with these 7 characters and have been consulting with members of the dwarfism community. And in fact, it was reported that the dwarves would not be dwarves, but simply magical creatures. But other members of the little person community were not bashful. As the Washington Post reported today, lesser-known dwarf actors such as Tara Jolie told IndieWire that many of her peers would love to perform in a Snow White remake, and she criticized Disney for listening to Dinklage instead of an entire community. The star of Snow White, the titular Snow White, Rachel Zegler, also, along the way, insulted Trump and everyone who voted for him, which presumably includes many ticket buyers. She wished that they would never know peace. She then deleted that post. Also, at a Disney fan event in 2022, this thing has been brewing for a long time, she called Prince Charming, quote, a guy who literally stalks Snow White. Literally, I think she must have meant. And if at this point you're already saying, oh, brother, this is getting grim, there is more. The Washington Post, in their rundown of the controversy, had a section called Gal Gadot and Gaza. Okay, the actress who plays the evil queen is Israeli, and Gal Gadot, Gaza, alliteration, so I'll allow it. But what is the connection between this particular actress and Gaza? I will quote the Washington Post. The lack of cast events has fed tabloid rumors of behind-the-scenes tensions between Zegler and her co-star Gadot, based largely on their opposing views on the Israel-Gaza war. They write, Zegler has long opposed Israel's occupation of Gaza and other Palestinian territory. After the first trailer for Snow White premiered online in August, she thanked fans for watching and added in an ex post, always remember, free Palestine. Well, that seems a little off message given the event, if you're trying to sell a movie. Since you already insulted Trump fans and fairy tale fans, I guess going all in and knowing your only possible audience are members of the Columbia University law and occupation community is a certain kind of marketing play. But what of Gadot? Here's what the Post writes. Gadot, who is Israeli and previously served in the Israel Defense Force, has been a vocal supporter of the country. I stand with Israel and you should too, she wrote on Instagram shortly after the war started in 2023. The world cannot sit on the fence while these horrific acts of terror are happening. Shortly after the war started, certainly makes it seem that she weighed in on the war, just as Rachel Zegler weighed in against the war. I looked it up. That post in question was put up on October 7th. The ground war was 20 days away. Her country had just been subject to its worst attack in history. This wasn't a debate over geopolitics. Of all the ways to frame it, Washington Post, this was not the fairest of them all. It might not have even actually been a debate among co-stars, just tabloid rumors thereof, but I do think it provides a chapter end for an era and an error engaging the public's appetite for entertainment wrapped in activism. The film is projected by Variety to underperform, vastly underperform, the traditional Disney remake. Which is a shame, because a friend of the Gist plays one of the 7 dwarves. He, by the way, in real life, is not of large stature, but probably not by enough to satisfy critics. And really, whoever is, like 6 out of 7 dwarves, they're not happy. And in this case, no one will live happily ever after. On the show today, a loss for Ukraine. But first, Joe Gatto is one of the original Impractical Jokers. He's doing stand-up now with a special named after his aesthetic or perhaps his life motto, messing with people. In this interview, we go pretty in-depth about how to conceive of and pull off sometimes humiliating stunts without having people hate you. In fact, with having them kind of love you, it helps to be an extremely charming and kind guy, as you will find Joe Gatto to be. He's up next.
Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from work we go.
Joe Gatto is a man after my own soul. He is a Staten Island native. He was friends with his high school pals. They went on to form a comedy group. They went on to do a little TV show called Impractical Jokers. Joe now does stand-up on his own. His new special is called Messing With People. You get it. It's part of the brand. He's got a podcast called Two Cool Moms. Yeah, a little discordant because he's not a mom, but he's always liked cool moms. And Joe, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Is stand-up always something you wanted to do, or it seems like more a natural progression? I'm a funny guy. I can make people laugh and enjoy themselves. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think it's. I think it was part of the next era of like trying to, you know, figure out how to keep entertaining live. I mean, it's funny because today, yesterday was March 4th, and that was 25 years to the first time we performed live as a group. Our first show for the Tenderloins improv troupe, me and the guys, was March 4th, 2000. So I've been performing live for a minute. So performing live was never a thing. Now, different mediums they're always in. There were improv shows, sketch comedy shows, live with the boys in our, you know, Impractical Jokers tour. And then now stand up solo is the next iteration of this.
Where was your first show 25 years ago?
The Producers Club. We put up our own things. It was on top of this restaurant, this 50-person theater, self-produced. Two shows sold out. We all brought our moms and families. Staten Island came out and represented.
That's the good thing about being in a group with four people. Yeah. You know,
you're only required for 25% of the ticket sales.
Right. And also like four people where most of them are Italian. Those are some big families usually, for demographically.
For sure.
Yeah. So how do you know if you're good or actually popular? You got to leave Staten Island, right, to test the theory.
For sure. You got to see when you stop telling the family about the shows and see who shows up. I think, you know, that's when the real test is, when you have strangers in the seats, not obligated family like it's a wedding.
Did you guys as the Tenderloin get big online or did you tour live and build the audience
Huge online. It was a mixture of both, but huge online because back then it was MySpace and YouTube, and the algorithm was actually editors of the homepage who were people, and people became fans of us and kept featuring us. So we kept getting featured on the homepages and the top comedian lists on MySpace. So it shared all our stuff, which linked to the YouTube. And on the YouTube homepage was all our latest sketches. And we were just cranking them out because we were part of this sketch comedy like program. It was like a competition called It's Your Show. Uh-huh. And they gave you once a week, you'd have to put up a themed sketch. So for like 11 weeks in a row, we were putting up a really funny sketch that was just garnering attention, you know?
And would someone win the competition, or was it just
it was a pilot for Fox,
right?
So they were trying to do, it was hosted by Carson Daly, and it was that time when sketch comedy, like the internet, took off, and people were like, how do we put the internet on TV, the thing that really matters? And they came up with this format of basically like an America's Funniest Videos, where instead of like those videos, it was sketch competition. So they got people, sketch groups, to submit on this theme, and then a studio audience would watch them and select their favorites, and whoever won would get the money. So we ended up winning $100,000 on a failed pilot that never saw air, but they still had to pay us.
Was this the era of Human Giant and Whitest Kids You Know, or was this even before then?
No, it was during or just after, you know, around there at the same time.
And did all these sketch artists, I know you're doing your own thing in your own places, but was there any sort of interacting with each other or getting to know each other or cross-pollination?
In New York, we used to go to UCB all the time, you know, our Pratt Citizens Brigade, when, you know, and that was the, you know, we would just go to all the shows. We'd go to the ASCAT show and watch like people perform. Like I remember seeing, you know, Amy Poehler, Horatio Sanz, all these people. I had befriended Rob Riggle, Rob Hubel, a bunch of guys there. I actually built Rob Riggle's first website. So I was a tech guy, and the way I got into like with performers, it got out pretty quickly that I could do people's websites and reels for them because I edited it as well. So all these comedians, and I ended up doing robriggle.com for him. We laugh about it now. I'm friends with him now. And like I built his first website for him and did his first demo reel. And I was like, you know, you owe me, buddy.
Wow.
I was like, you're welcome.
was that your niche with the group, or did you all? Okay. So what did all the other guys, and these are all the guys from Impractical Jokers, were in the Tenderloin?
Yeah, so the Tenderloins were, our fourth member was a guy named Mike, but he had dropped out because he got a real job and a real family.
He said, screw you guys.
Still like, he grew up, like he grew up too quick. You know, he's like, he got a real gig. He became like vice president of a PR firm or whatnot, and which I think he's the president of now. He's like, he's doing great. We're still friends with him. He's got a beautiful family, and you know, he just grew up quicker than we did, you know?
So to his detriment, financially, yeah. I guess.
So he dropped out. He's doing fine. He's doing fine for himself. So he dropped out, and then Q was always a featured guest on our shows. He would do something called the monologues where he would come up and tell a story and we would build off that story. So he just was a natural fit. When we had the hole and we started moving into sketch comedy, filmed sketch comedy, he was a great writer. So we brought him in and said, hey, do you want to do this with us? And we started doing it. And he added a real cool voice to the whole thing. Different perspective, a little darker humor. And it was just that was the magic sauce, I think, the four of us together to really take off.
When you were at UCB, was there any rivalries? Because there's a way to do it. There's classes to graduate from at UCB. Yeah. And sometimes sketch people are a little territorial. This is the way to do it. This is not the way to do it. You guys were friends from high school. Your auditions were just like the four funniest guys from your high school, right? So did they look at you as like, who are these guys? They're not as, I don't know, official or as artistic as the rest of the UCB type people?
No, we didn't take classes there, but we were known there because we'd always show up and watch and laugh and then talk to people after and learn and things. And then people started finding out about our shows because it was like, who are these Tenderloins guys that are putting these shows up, you know, kind of things. And there was a lot of cross-pollination in that sense, but we didn't really take the classes. I think when we did Jokers and the comedy scene, we came onto the comedy scene, people who were comedians quickly realized it's not a basic cable reality prank show. It's a well thought out comedy. Like comedians can see that instantly. You know, it's a written thing where we kind of think about what we're going to say, have ideas. We develop these sketch ideas to create a scenario where comedy could be birthed from. So I think there was a lot of that. And really quickly inside, we were pretty accepted by comedians because it was like these guys have created something, that lightning in a bottle kind of deal that is funny and well known and loved very quickly. And these were all people we were fans of, you know, these are people that, you know, we realized, I still remember we went to the Grown Ups 2 premiere and Adam Sandler was in front of us and he turned around and was like, hey, Joe. And I was like, what? Like, you're Adam Sandler, you know, like that. And he like took a picture with me and Murray. Like it was crazy. You know, his kid watched the show or whatever. And he was, you know, was just like, oh, I'm a huge fan. You know, you guys are great. Keep doing your thing. And I was like, there's nothing that's like, you think about this little basic cable show that you're doing and how it just kind of infiltrated inside the comedy world, which was really cool.
You guys didn't just let her rip and think that, oh, weird funniness will happen. There was a lot of planning out. There is, I would imagine, something very close to a writer's room. But before that, when you pitched, so here you are getting heat, you're winning these competitions, you're involved in the comedy scene in New York, not just in a website building angle.
User interface design.
Right. Not just, capacity. Not just C++, but actual, you know, funny stuff on the inside. Tell me about why wasn't the way for you guys to get big to take the sketch that you were known for and do something in the world of sketch or something that was
yeah,
more...
Yeah, we tried.
No, right.
Didn't happen.
Fiction. It just didn't happen. And so you needed an angle.
Yeah, we had a Somebody sketch advised show. You, we had a sketch show. Yeah, we had a sketch show with Spike TV and it didn't go.
Yeah.
So we did this Spike TV show, but what it did do was get the, you know, we had gotten the attention of an agent and the agent was like, these guys have something here. We should take them around. But then our agent told us we were too old for TV.
Right.
And he was like, so when they bought Jokers, it was a bidding war between MTV and True TV. And so we tried sketch didn't work. And then our last ditch effort was like, let's be our funniest. What's our funniest? And this embarrassment comedy is how we've always made it. I've always made those guys laugh that way. It was always natural. And it was like, we should just capture it. So we literally took out our cell phones, did a sizzle reel. And we went around and we called it Mission Uncomfortable. Around New York and did a couple stupid things. You know, there was a screening of a Tyler Perry movie in Times Square. I had to get up in the middle of it and tell everybody I farted and excuse myself. So I did it in a huge way. And I went down over the steps. I didn't use the steps. I climbed over people. And people, for some reason, thought it was hysterical and started applauding me. And the guys are like, are you kidding me? How does that even happen? You know, then Murray went and people said, shut up, sit down. It was just instantly showed the dynamic, you know. And then we just did another stupid one where we had to ask as grown men, we were in our late 20s, where we could go to the bathroom, but we couldn't say bathroom. We're like, excuse me, where can I make a peeps? Or where can I do a poops? And that's what we would say and not laugh. We had to try And we just crumbled because it was just so stupid, you know? And we made this great, like, reel. When the reel came in and we showed it, it got in a bidding war between MTV and True TV, and MTV wanted to recast us and make it a strip show, meaning it would go 5 days a week with a different cast, young kids doing these challenges together.
Right.
And True TV was like, no, you guys are the secret sauce. Let's put you guys, make you guys the poster children and do it. And it literally came down to a coin flip. There's four of us, two and two, where we were split, and we flipped a coin, and True TV came out on top.
Which side were you on?
I was on True TV.
See, you nailed it because
MTV. Yeah, well, I mean, I got lucky. We don't know. I mean, I could have been a multi-billionaire now if we sold it to MTV. Who knows?
I guess, but, you know, they wanted to do a version of Wild and Out, right? We've seen the shows that they do where they get really good-looking younger people to do it, right, Ashton Kutcher, right, or whatever. I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like that is the path to success. The deal with True TV must have been like, aren't you guys doing like Murdered Wives and
no comedy?
Yeah,
no comedy.
Was that the two who voted against it? Was that a big stumbling block? What is True?
That was a very great point. Yeah. It was a very great point. Literally, what the point was, we worked so hard. The 2 points we were against of is like, you want to be at that time, MTV was the place. You know, it was like, you want to be here versus do you want to put your comedy and fate in the hands of strangers?
Yeah.
Like those were the two, and they're both impossible. You land on one or the other, and both agreed with the other point. It wasn't like, you're crazy. Like, we both were like, wow. I was like, I feel, these are the 2 points. I feel more strongly about this one than that one. And you're both extremely valid points. So you're right. We weren't arguing about it. It was like, this is where we ended up.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, so what do we do?
That's even a harder discussion to have. It's a nice and polite and high-minded discussion, but there's no way to
never got heated. Got people trying to sell each other. We never talked to each other that way. It was always like, look, this is my point. This is how I'm thinking. You respect me as a person, a friend, a comedian. This is how I'm thinking. Maybe you'll come that way. Maybe you won't, you know? So it was like a little bit of that. There's only been, you know, we were four. So it was always, there's only been like three or four coin flips in our whole history together, which is insane. Like, we were really on the same page a lot. So, you know, that's what it came down to. But True TV, we literally, season one, they were court TV till 5 p.m. They didn't even have original programming. They showed litigation. And then they switched over to mainly tow truck reality shows. We aired between Lizard Lick Towing and South Beach Tow in the middle, four middle-aged fat guys running around the supermarket causing a problem. You know what I mean? So it was like just such a weird place to be. And to their, you know, to their credit, they turned that network on its ear. They were like, we're a comedy now.
Yeah.
This is a runaway hit. Let's, you know, embrace it. And they tried a bunch of comedies, you know?
Did you guys keep the coin?
that's very funny because in our spinoff show, Dinner Party, that we did during COVID, one of the conversations in that was about that coin, and Q actually had a different coin. And I don't think we have the coin anymore. Q was looking for, because Q has like a bunch of like, he's like coins and whatnot. So he had one, and I think we were at his place maybe. I forgot where it was, but he had a coin. And that was the coin. And then we recreated in Dinner Party where we made the flip of the coin kind of thing as a shout out to that.
The other aspect of it, debating between the two. In 2000, what was it, around 2010, you were making the decision?
Yeah.
Yeah. MTV was iconic. And for people of our generation, we are similar ages. It's cool. It was just the coolest thing. And it's also cool and youth and a great brand. And since then, I don't want to say anything that's not unkind, but the brand has become much less of what it was. And I was thinking about this the other day. This might blow your mind. So what's the iconic picture and symbol of MTV? The MTV Music Award shows a statue of what?
The astronaut, right?
Right, the astronaut. The Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. The time from the moon landing to the first video on MTV was 14 years. The time, just 14 years, the time from the first video on MTV until now is 45 years.
Really?
Yeah, oh my God. Right? Because it was 1981, I think. Or maybe it was 82. Yeah. But still, I mean, so that's not even a close amount of distance. The nostalgia we have for MTV being cool is sometimes like, one way to look at it is three times the nostalgia for that MTV had for the moon landing.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, it all goes through a lens though, right? It's all nostalgic and, or, you know, everybody gets the spotlight moves to somebody else. It's ebb and flow. People go out of business. There's mergers. There's whatnots, you know, something becomes the cool one. Comedy Central becomes it. And then it becomes, it's MTV. Then it's Netflix. Then it's, you know, whoever it is now, you know? So I really just think it's interesting to think back in the day, there was just so many less options, even with cable. You know, there was so many, I'm sorry, but now there's, you know, there's so many more ways to get it out there for content creators, even in your own ways. Like, I think about if YouTube was then, when we started, what it is now, would we even have needed a network? You know, like YouTube now is a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm. But you that might have been like, worse. And the algorithm might have been pushing you into things that you didn't want to do. Like, you basically 100%. Did what you wanted to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So here is my, I'm sure other people have said this, but the secret sauce that explains why Impractical Jokers has been so successful, was so successful for all the years you were on, is humanity. You guys clearly love each other, and almost all the time the joke is on you, and if someone's uncomfortable with the joke, you'll pixelate them out or maybe not even use it. And there's an extent to which the torture doesn't go. Like, you could, you know, if there's one of the punishments, you know, you might put spiders on one of the guy's bodies, but maybe not their face. You won't really physically torture them. And I think even without explicitly communicating it, the audience, that resonates with the audience. I mean, do you think that's accurate?
For sure. I mean, we all signed up for it. That's the thing. So nobody's getting bullied, right? Everybody knows what they're in for. You can say no, right? So it's just if you want to or not, if you want to try to endure it. Like, so that was the premise that really helped it all. At the end of the day, it's like, we're friends. When the show stops, that's your best friend. So like, you're not going to do things to your best friend that you're going to do it, you know, that you are going to go. People are like, is anything off limits? Yeah. I mean, of course, we're friends. I'm not going to put my friends through something that's going to be terrible. If something was really pushing them, like, we would ask them if they'd want to do it. Or would that be possible to do it? I wouldn't throw Murray in a snake pit knowing how scary he is with snakes to be like, listen, we have this really funny idea for a snake. If you're up for it, would you do something? And if he says no, okay, then that snake punishment doesn't happen. But if he says, all right, is it funny? Yeah, it's funny. Trust us, it's going to be good. All right, I'll do it. Then it's different, you know? So those kind of things are parts of the show. I mean, when you say the humanity, I mean, at its core, it's friendship on display. So everybody relates to that. I think that's really good. I think that's why a lot of the reboots and spinoffs and attempts all failed. Mm-hmm. You can't cast what we have. Everybody knows it, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes the ones or the pranks, let's call it, that get the most attention are just the most outrageous. And those people will become notorious, right? You could get notorious for being a prank, but you don't become beloved. And
That's a great way to put it.
I think you're the only show. Everyone knows I'm Candid Camera, but it was many years ago. And I've actually
That was it, man. Yeah. We were basing our stuff on that. But even Candid Camera. See, there's a difference because Candid Camera, people got pranked, and then there was a love for Candid Camera. When you heard the words, you're on Candid Camera, people would be like, oh, am I? Like, it didn't matter what just happened to you because you were part of a family and a culture and of something loved. You became a cast member of a beloved institution instantly, right? For us, when we were like, you're on Impractical Jokers, they're like, what the hell is that? Because if people knew about the show, it didn't work if they were on it, so they couldn't be on it.
Yeah.
So anybody that we're literally trying to explain our show to people to get them to want to be on it. So we were behind a big challenge there. We couldn't tell people you're on Jokers. And they'd be like, yay, because we didn't want them to know it. If they knew it, they got skipped.
Yeah.
Anytime somebody recognized us, you're out the door. Sorry. Yeah. It just doesn't work.
And in later seasons, you could tell that became a harder and harder, a higher hurdle. Sure. I was watching, was it the very first episode when you guys were working at a White Castle?
The first episode was.
And White is that Castle, White Castle in Lynbrook, by the way?
Lynbrook, yeah.
That's the only White Castle I went to, right next to the train station.
Yeah, okay. there's one we filmed there twice, and then there was one, I think, in Massapequa that had the drive through. So that was the drive through one.
Ladies and gentlemen, the White Castles of Nassau County. As I was watching that, I said to myself, this is great. The reactions are great. I bet by season four, a full third of these people are in the exact demographic that will be watching Impractical 100%. Jokers. You couldn't have done it.
But you make adjustments. You do little things, like you learn, you know, like I said, we're seasoned comedians too. We're not just friends, you know, messing around. They're like, okay, how can we reinvent? How can we do things? How can we stack the deck so we know people aren't going to know us? So the focus groups came more and more into play because we could literally have people pre-interviewed. And just one of the questions has, what shows do you watch? And highlight, circle the ones you watch. And if you picked Impractical Jokers, you didn't get picked for the thing. And then when people came into the room, we would check each other's marks in. I'd be at the desk when it was Murray's turn. They didn't recognize me. They're not going to recognize Murray. You're in on the show, you know? So it'd be like that kind of stuff. We do those little tricks that would help.
Joe Gatto is one of the original Impractical Jokers. His new special is a description of his life, messing with people. Thanks so much, Joe.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
And I subscribe to Pesca Plus, and you should too. I give myself a free subscription. For you, it'll be relatively cheap. You could get the ad-free version. You could get the bonus content version. I bring it up now because Joe Gatto and I, we talked and talked and talked, and it was an entertaining talk, an exciting talk. And because of that talk, I had more to give, and I'm giving it to you. If you go to subscribe.mikepesca.com for all of this and more, there is an April book club we are going to announce soon. Just don't get all the ads, except maybe this one where it says subscribe to Pesca Plus at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. Ukraine is lost. I'm optimistic. I'm careful not to fall into despair or catastrophe. But I've concluded Ukraine is lost. Ukraine is going to lose this war. That Oval Office meeting, public embarrassment, you know, it doesn't actually matter. The administration doesn't care about preserving Ukraine's autonomy or saving Ukraine's children. And nothing would be different if Zelensky had played nice in that one-day meeting. All that would have happened is that there would have been one fewer news cycle for Trump officials and factotums to praise him as strong and worthy of deference.
And that's what Zelensky did, unfortunately, is he found every opportunity to try to Ukraine-splain on every issue.
And by the way, when I said children, save their children, it is because the government, our government, just defunded a Yale-based project tracking the many 20,000 estimated Ukrainian children abducted and taken into Russia. This is a crime against humanity. Yes, it is, and the U.S. doesn't care. We'll not be pursuing the return of kidnapped children as a condition of peace. There seem to be no conditions of peace. I don't know. Maybe Putin can say something or do something personally insulting to Donald Trump's interests, and then things would change. But right now, Trump's interest and Putin's interest are almost perfectly aligned. Freeze fighting right now. Freeze Russian gains. Leave Ukraine vulnerable. You know, the only reason Kyiv is not in the hands of Russian actors is one thing. It's that the U.S. is so enormously powerful. And before Trump was elected, we didn't want Russia to succeed militarily. And there is no conflict in the world that America, if it really cared, couldn't have an enormous effect on. Now, notice I didn't say there's no conflict that the U.S. couldn't win, because right now you're hearing this and you're saying, wait a minute, we're always told that the U.S. is so enormously powerful, but did we win the war in Iraq? Did we win the war in Afghanistan? Sure, superpower status, but we didn't win those. Well, I would say in Iraq, we did win. Iraq's leader was deposed, killed, and we brought democracy to Iraq. Okay, the leaders that the Iraqis want aren't perfectly aligned with who we want the Iraqis to want, but that's democracy. The U.S. now buys oil from Iraq. Iraq is a U.S. ally, and Iraq buys from the United States, I guess, some military contractors. The reason that we didn't, quote, win those wars is that the U.S. defies winning so enormously high, we will not accept a 2-to-1 trade in casualties. We will not accept a 50-to-1 trade in casualties. Killing more of our enemy is so far from the criteria that America uses to define if we win a war. We will not accept a timeline of decades for defining a win. Our adversaries will accept that ratio of losses. They have to. Our adversaries will accept a timeline of decades. Don't even think about the wars. It may be hard to get your head around. Just think about a couple of distinct U.S. battles that the U.S. has lost. Mogadishu, Black Hawk Down, huge embarrassment for the Clinton presidency. What happened there? 18 soldiers lost their lives, but so did 2,000 Somalis. Yes, the U.S. lost, but we lost at a ratio of, what is that? More than 10-to-1. Take the withdrawal of Afghanistan, which Trump ridiculously calls
perhaps the most embarrassing moment in the history of our country.
What are the facts of that? At Abbey Gate, 13 members of the U.S. military were killed. But so were over 150 Afghans, some by suicide bombers, many by the United States firing upon them. But more importantly, why did the U.S. so desperately have to leave Afghanistan? It was a, quote, forever war, and we weren't winning it, right? But the deaths at Abbey Gate were the first in a year and a half for U.S. troops in Afghanistan. We left because of this branding of forever war and because 2,500, a little under that, U.S. service members lost their lives. But the U.S. and their allies killed almost, or maybe even more than, 100,000 Taliban. This is a war we lost because we define winning so prohibitively. And you know, that's a good thing. That's generally a good thing. It's a sign of an advanced, flourishing country that should rightly be very sensitive to the costs of war. But it does mean it's very hard for the U.S. to conceive of a long, hard conflict which ends in glory. Parades, a shared story of sacrifice, of it all being worth it in the end. We haven't had that in 80 years. But as adverse to loss of life, or to some extent to limb and brain, as we are as Americans, we do always spend money for some other entity to fight on behalf of the U.S. interests. It has been, for the last 70 years, the story that if others are willing to lose their lives in a cause that we deem not even righteous, but in the interests of the United States, we will give those fighters the means to pursue their cause. And let me tell you, the means are massive. The means are impressive. And in these battles, the means are often overwhelming. U.S. munitions, U.S. equipment, U.S. technology is awesome, overwhelming. It's also awesomely expensive. A HIMARS missile cost $150,000. That's just one. We sell them in pods of six. That's $1 million right there. An F-16 Fighting Falcon, which, like the HIMARS, has been used in the theater in Ukraine to great effect, those can cost between $60 and $70 million each. Now, the F-22s, those cost over $300 million each by some credible calculations. We won't give those to the Ukrainians to fight. But for the last 50 years, we definitely have decided to accept the trade-off of expense and military wins. But no more. This is an exception to that. Trump says it's about money. I think it's about his perennial sensitivity to being ripped off and made a sucker of. Plus, there is, you know, you can't deny that there is definitely a strongman tropism going along. Zelensky's appeal to most of us in the West, right? Not just the Biden administration, but the majority of legislators and other Western officials, the countries of Europe. You know, his great strength was he actually was a believer in democracy and certainly was an opposer of autocracy. Virtue has become flaw under Donald Trump, and the Russians have won. They will win. North Korea did very well, too. Fantastic. Now, as I see Zelensky forced to capitulate in all but some portions of his rhetoric, and Putin asked to accept nothing short of his wish list, the best Ukraine can hope for is Europe throwing up some roadblocks to keep Russia from rolling all over them. And then maybe in 3 years, 9 months, a different U.S. leader makes different choices, though by then it may well be too late. And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara with CBSO Michelle Pesca. Edgar Vasquez makes our video. He made this one into a video. You can check them out at our YouTube page at Pesca Gist. Umpuru G Puru Du Puru, and thanks for listening.